Our final case for oral argument this morning is 23-1942, United States v. Creek. Mr. Sharonis, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Damon Sharonis and I represent the appellant in this matter, Jeffrey Creek. On appeal, we have raised three issues all related to Mr. Creek's sentencing. The first issue is whether the district court erred in applying the destructive device enhancement, and the second and third issues deal with whether or not the sentence was procedurally and substantively reasonable. So I'd like to start my discussion with the court today by dealing with the destructive device enhancement. As the court knows from reading the papers, Mr. Creek was found in possession of a device that was made of a tin can, was epoxied shut, it had a fuse and explosive powder. The government moved for a two-level enhancement at sentencing, and Mr. Creek's lawyer at the trial court level objected. As this court knows, the government has the burden to establish that the enhancement is applicable in a case.
But only by a preponderance of the evidence, right? And
agreed.
Our standard of review is clear error.
Well, it's clear error for the findings of fact, for sure. But I think the application of those facts to the underlying, or the final decision of the enhancement would be a de novo issue.
I mean, the problem with determining these types of things, a destructive device, the statutory language is sort of broad, right? And the district judge, it's almost like credibility. I mean, the district judge is looking at the device and, you know, the defendant says, well, I threw it in the water and it made a big boom, or I threw it in a field or it made a big boom, or I threw it in a bar and it made a big boom. I mean, you know, that's a bomb, right?
Well,
and that's the problem.
I think. Well, I think I can answer that question. I think that the precedent in this district, in the circuit, has decided that these issues, first of all, need to be decided on a case-by-case analysis, and that the statute is supposed to be looked at in a precise but flexible manner. And I think what really happens in these situations is the courts are taking away from defendants the arguments that I'm just kidding. In other words, if you find a device.
Well, I think that's a very good point. But the problem is with the ghost guns, you know, you know what I mean? Like, you got all these guns and ammunition. It's just weird. I mean, you put the district court in a situation to say, well, we've got ghost guns. We've got hundreds of rounds of ammunition. We've got a convicted felon, and we've got convicted felon who's at least using methamphetamine on a nearly daily basis and perhaps distributing it, I don't know. But then over in the corner, we've got this firework. Like, that's, you know, then you're asking us to send it back to the district court to say, try again.
I think the district court erred in their analysis by mistakenly relying on Copas and Johnson in a way that really extended that reasoning. The Copas, and if you look at the transcript at the beginning of the sentencing hearing, the district court judge essentially said, because this was a metal device, even though I think it was a tin can, if you look at the device, I think what it was actually like a chewing tobacco can, because it was a metal canister, because it was epoxied shut and had a wick, it was a destructive device, and it relied on Copas. That's not what Copas says.
I guess kind of echoing some of the concerns that Judge Kirsch has, I'm not really sure what a district judge is to do. Is your position that a district judge always has to take testimony from some sort of expert, whether the government offers one, or, you know, the government offers an agent or what have you, to make that determination, or otherwise, how else is it supposed to make that determination?
I think that, and again, if we go back to sort of the standard that this court has put forward, there's a two-step process. And the two-step process is, one, if looking at the objective features of the device, you cannot say automatically, this is a weapon, because that's what the statute is meant to protect people from and to prescribe punishment for weapons. So if you look
and
at
isn't your position that the government needed to offer some evidence to support its contention that it, objectively speaking, that it is a weapon, is a destructive device?
I think they had to do more than they did. I don't think they did anything. I think if you look at Mr. Creek's statement, which was what they relied on, that this was something he uses a firework, throws to make a big boom, that is not different than what somebody would use a firework for, which the court has held has a commercial and legitimate purpose, right? So I think what the court had to do in this situation is look at the objective features. And this court has pointed to certain objective features that would take it out of the realm of the just kidding defense, right? Shrapnel, nails, things like that. And that didn't happen here. there was really no analysis of this device other than the district court saying a device in COPIS, which was somewhat similar, was found to be a destructive device. Therefore, this is a destructive device.
Wasn't it a little bit more than that, though? She made a factual determination that the device was fully assembled and that it was comparing to COPIS. It was fully assembled. It had the metal canister. It had the gunpowder. It had the wick. It seemed to me that she was proceeding under F1 by saying that and concluding that based on all of the components that were fully assembled, that that was sufficient under our case law to qualify as a destructive device. And I don't need to go any further and look at intent or to the sure. second step you've identified.
My response to that is the COPIS case, which she relied on. Actually, the government and the court missed the moreover portion of that case, where they say not only does it have to be these things, but moreover, and this was a sufficiency case, COPIS was, it says, moreover, the government presented evidence that the device could cause bodily injury or property damage. And they actually, in COPIS, interestingly enough, looked at the specific intent of the defendant, because the defendant in COPIS said this is just meant to blow up stumps. The government presented evidence that this would not be.
But I think when you take COPIS and Johnson together, it's pretty clear if it qualifies as a destructive device, that if it's clear there's it's a bomb or it's a destructive device, that you don't need to go to the second step and look into intent.
But the question is, how do you get to that point? And the issue there is there are clearly things that this court, that Hammond, that other courts have said are clearly destructive devices. And those are usually situations, you know, the Hammond plus factor, which I know is not from this circuit, but it's actually what Johnson says, just not as clearly. Johnson says there will be situations where when looking at the device, it is not clearly something that goes into F1. So there are fully assembled devices that are not clearly weapons, essentially. And when we get to that point, and I submit that there was no evidence that this device was clearly a weapon, or clearly the type of device in COPIS, which had detonators, they found it attached to grenades and pipe bombs, or all these other things in COPIS. Here what we had was a small device. There was no testimony as to the type of explosion it could make, if there was any shrapnel, if it could hurt anyone. That didn't exist. So when the court was confronted with that situation, they should have said, well, wait a second, this is not clearly a weapon. I may find at the end of the day that it is a weapon, but the analysis is, if it's not clearly a weapon, which we suggest this was not, we then have to look at the subjective intent. And that then leads to the next step. And there was no, and I understand Judge Kirsch's statement that, well, it wasn't like he had this device and then there was a bunch of, Candyland games laying around. Certainly there were other things in his house, but the court never even got to that point. You know, the court really just, respectfully, with short shrift, said, because this device has similar characteristics to that in COPIS, we are going to find this is a destructive device. So there was no separate analysis as to this specific device. And I think that cuts against Judge Ripple's statement in Johnson that states we need to look at these cases specifically, the devices specifically, through the crucible of case-by-case analysis. So I think, and hopefully I'll have a little bit of time left, I think the government did not prove it was a destructive device first, and secondly, the district court erred by not going through the steps that
not Johnson looking at intent.
Out. Well, yes, because objectively, I don't think this qualified as a weapon, and then they'd have to look to the intent. So, for those reasons, we believe that this court should either reverse the finding of the destructive device enhancement or remand it for the court to use what we suggest would be the proper analysis. And I'll reserve my minute 12 for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Sharonis. Mr. Bloodworth. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. Thank you. Casey Bloodworth, representing the Appellee United States. Your Honors were correct that when reading COPIS and Johnson together, the district court's analysis on whether the enhancement under B3B and 2K2.1 applies is correct. This was a fully assembled device. And as this court made clear in Johnson, a fully assembled device, the analysis falls under subsection F1 of 5845. The evidence was clear.
But isn't, I mean, I want to get back to our test here. Do we have to find any of that here to affirm? I mean, why is our analysis just simply the district court made the determination by a preponderance of the evidence, and she did not clearly err, period?
I think the court can affirm when answering those questions in the affirmative. There certainly was sufficient evidence by a preponderance standard that this device was similar to a bomb. It had ignitable powders, explodable powders. I believe the testimony or the evidence was that it was chloride, aluminum powders. Had a wick. It was fully encapsulated.
I mean, there's no doubt you would concede that this weapon may have been a firework. In other words, a firework can be used as a bomb. If someone walks into a crowded grocery store with a half stick of dynamite, it could be similar to a bomb. Right. If somebody on the 4th of July at 10 o'clock puts a half stick of dynamite on like a sewer drain, right, so they light it, it makes this gigantic boom, maybe it's not intended to be used as a bomb, but it's the same thing. Half stick of dynamite is a half stick of dynamite.
I do believe that's correct. And when you look at a fully assembled device such as that, or such as what Mr. Creek had, I believe the analysis ends.
Is that the key from your standpoint that the district court made the factual determination that it was fully assembled?
I think that's part of the analysis.
If the court had not made the determination that it was fully assembled,
I think
you have to go to step two in Johnson?
I don't think you would have to, because as Judge Kirsch pointed out, the standard on whether or not that was error is whether there was evidence by a preponderance of the evidence and there was clear error. There was evidence by a preponderance that this device was similar to a bomb. There's nothing that's been pointed out that's clear error, the district court relied on something that was an error of fact or not in evidence. So I think the analysis can end there and the case can be affirmed. But to answer your question, if for some reason, hypothetically speaking, those findings weren't made, I think the analysis could have continued. Okay, is this a completed device? Yes, this is a completed device. So I think we have to look at 5845F1, and then the analysis can end. I don't think it would have been error for the district court to say, I don't know if this is a completed device. So they could then continue on and look, is this a combination of a parts where subjective intent is relevant? And I think Johnson does a great job of pointing that out, because in Johnson, I believe the district court went on to exercise discretion and look at subjective intent on the device there because of one very important point. It wasn't a fully assembled device. The device in Johnson was not capable of exploding, or at least there was some evidence presented. I believe the evidence in Johnson was that the wick didn't actually protrude into the ignitable powders. I think that illustrates probably what I'm in art for.
And that's my question, if given Johnson, if this were not fully assembled or if the court had not made that factual determination, do you automatically go to the second step? Or is it still possible that you could find it's a bomb or a destructive device without going to that second step?
Yeah, I don't think it's automatic. I think you could find it without going to that second step. And I think that's what the district court here did, based on evidence, on a preponderance standard.
Well, the court here found it was fully assembled.
Right. So maybe I'm just misunderstanding the court's question, and I apologize for that. But I don't think you automatically have to go to that second step. I think if the evidence that's presented leads you to that, I think the court has discretion to do so, as this court said in Johnson, when you're dealing with a device that may not be capable of igniting, which was what the device was in Johnson. But at the end of the day, the evidence was clear to the district court that this was a fully assembled device. Compared in the district court did compare it to the device in COPUS. There was no discernible difference between the two devices. And there's no reason to come up to a different result before this court, I would submit. So I think the court's application of the enhancement in 2K2.1 was proper. It was supported by evidence, by preponderance, and there was no clear error in relying on that evidence. Additionally, I think the court's procedures were sound. Her upper variance, which was a significant variant sentence, was supported by her analysis of the district court's analysis of the 3553A factors. So unless there are any further questions, the government would rest on its brief and ask the court to affirm the judgment and sentence below.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Bledwick.
Thank you.
Mr. Sharonis.
Got a lot to say in a minute and 10 seconds.
I'll give you your 2 minutes.
Okay. Thank you. You know, Judge Kirsch asked a really interesting question to the government. The government conceded, and what Judge Kirsch asked was, well, come on, this could be a firework, or it could be considered a firework. Now, if there was shrapnel in this, if there was metal in this, or excuse me, if there was or nails in this, Judge Kirsch wouldn't have asked that question because we would not be able to argue objectively that this was a firework. But because those things don't exist, there is that issue as to whether or not this is a weapon or this is a firework. And when you have that issue, when you have that legitimate issue, which you won't have in every case, you can't come into somebody's house and execute a warrant, and he's got pipe bombs with galvanized steel and nails and say, this is just a firework. But here, as Judge Kirsch asked and the government conceded, this could be potentially a firework. So all we're asking in that situation, when it's not clearly a destructive device, you go to the analysis that Johnson stands for. And if the government is proposing that because this device was assembled, you cannot look at the subjective intent of Mr. Creek, they are wrong. Johnson says specifically there will be times with assembled devices where we look at the subjective intent, and they point to the Wurstein case, which is a great case because that deals with two devices. One of them is a pipe bomb that they would not allow them to argue under any standard was anything other than a weapon, and the other device was more akin to a firecracker, and they took the subjective intent of the defendants into consideration. I think these were younger kids, and there was no evidence they were trying to harm anybody and things along those lines. So they correctly analyzed it in Johnson and Wurstein. I think the problem with the government—
So do you need to, though, if it could be a firework or a bomb, do you need to look at intent if this goes back to what Judge Kirsch started with? If the other surroundings suggest to you and establish for you by a preponderance of the evidence that it was a destructive device?
When you talk about the other surroundings, Judge, are you talking about
the ammunition, guns?
What was interesting is that was never mentioned. That was never mentioned. Now, we can assume the court thought that, but the court did not say, because of the other things found in this house, we are going to hold that this was a destructive device. What the court said was, I am bound by COPUS to find that this is a destructive device because there are some similarities between the devices. And if you read COPUS, it's a much more serious device than what was found in Mr. Creek's case. So I think that the court had to go through the analysis, and they did not. They mistakenly relied on COPUS, and they also said, because this device is assembled, we don't need to look at intent. And that's not what our circuit has held.
Thank you, Mr. Sharonis. Thanks to both counsel. The court will take this case under advisement, and we are in recess for the day.